It's a great treat to be back in this place, in this pulpit, and to see a vibrant, lively, committed congregation. I think I'm seeing more people than I remember from the latter part of the 1960s. Way to go. And it's very good to have good colleagues. I appreciate your invitation to preach. And it's good to see Andrea Greenwood, who was one of my hosts last night, and Mary Catherine Morn, about whom I'll say more, and David Park, who was one of my teachers in seminary. Good grief. But on to Selma and beyond. Selma, Alabama has been in many minds recently. Unitarian Universalists, maybe even more than the average. Of course, there's the Hollywood movie that has reminded us. Excellent, excellent book by my colleague and buddy Mark Morrison Reed, The Selma Awakening, How the Civil Rights Movement Tested and Changed Unitarian Universalism. I commend this book also to you. Very well done, very provocative book. And I was part of the committee that put together an observance of Unitarian Universalist involvement in Selma back in 1965. And we were originally thinking, well, maybe 150. Ultimately, some 500 people took part in those events last March in Birmingham and Selma. And there were some significant subsequent stories in the Unitarian Universalist World magazine. Selma was and is a significant identifier for us as Unitarian Universalists. Maybe this is illustrated, can be illustrated by a story about a colleague, one of our military chaplains, who was serving as interim minister of a Michigan congregation. And being in Michigan, being a commissioned military chaplain, he was assigned to duty with, I think it was a National Guard unit that drew heavily from the Detroit area. And I was not fully aware of this, but those who serve as chaplains are commissioned officers in their branch of the service, but they are defined as non-combatants, so they cannot carry a weapon. Well, to deal with this problem in combat zones, they are assigned a chaplain's assistant who can be armed. Actually, I think the significant thing about the chaplain's assistant is this is an enlisted person or a non-commissioned officer who can help this maybe intellectually equipped but not militarily fully familiar character not mess up too badly. So, colleague reported for his first weekend of duty with this unit and discovered that the chaplain's assistant was a middle-aged, no-nonsense black woman out of Detroit who was proper, but obviously sizing up this white guy from who knows where, from a religious group she had never heard of before. He said the second weekend of duty, she came in, said, "Sir, I looked you all up. You were in Selma. We're going to be okay." Theodore Parker Church had a role in Selma. This congregation okayed their young, just ordained minister to go to Selma on behalf of the Unitarian Universalist Association early in the Selma events. Ira Blaylock and I were sent to check to see if there might be a role for Unitarian Universalists in the Selma movement. And the congregation put up with my spending a week in jail and missing a scheduled Sunday in the pulpit. But more than that, and more than putting up with probably more civil rights-oriented sermons in the immediate aftermath of that than most people really were eager to hear. For example, a couple of years later, we were presented with the opportunity to buy a newer house to serve as parsonage and sell the huge old frame house at 20 Wren Street that was the parsonage that Judy and I had moved into. 20 Wren Street was a fascinating place, three stories tall, with maybe two or three specks of insulation. It cost a ton to heat and so on, much bigger than we really needed as parsonage. And I persuaded the standing committee to first list it with Fair Housing Incorporated so that a black family that ordinarily would have been denied any opportunity to look at any property in a community as nice as West Roxbury would have a chance at buying. Standing committee said yes, and it was sold to a family of color, which was radical for 1960s West Roxbury. So, for Theodore Parker Church, Selma, yes, but more than Selma. And if that was true for Theodore Parker Church here in West Roxbury, it was truer still for Southern Unitarian Universalists. My recent book, mentioned already, attempts to expand our memory. It tells of Southern Unitarian Universalists working on issues of justice, particularly related to race, well before Selma and long after. By valuing justice, equity, human dignity, inclusion in the democratic process, Southern Unitarian Universalists got well out of step with the white Southern majority. On their good days, Southern Unitarian Universalists got the parable of the Good Samaritan. They understood, like Camus, that they might diminish evil if not prevent it. They chose to not be unduly conformed to the biases of their world. So, what did that nonconformity look like? Well, mostly it wasn't some one big, brave stance, but thousands of small stories, what I've referred to elsewhere as small acts of great courage. It could be as simple as a cup of coffee or a PTA meeting. One of my favorite stories comes from one of Mary Catherine's parishioners, Virginia Price, who said, "The main thing I did in civil rights was drink enough coffee to float a battleship. I went to the little lunch bar at Harvey's and the 10-cent stores. We'd go to the lunch counter and find a place by a black person and sit down. And what could you do but order a cup of coffee and do that several times and then go on to another place? So I kept on the run for several days. I forget exactly how long we did it." This was during the sit-ins. She was serving as a white, indicating that not all of us would flee if black people were served. She was a young mother, active in the Parent Teachers Association. She said, "There were separate white and black PTAs. When I was so active in PTA, I tried to get cooperation between the two groups as much as I could, not making much progress in it. I went out to Pearl High School, a black high school, to a meeting, and the PTA president was talking about how many people she'd invited from the white PTA, and she said none of them would come. The person sitting next to me, I could see peripherally, pointing to me to remind the president that I was sitting there. She said, 'Oh, Mrs. Price, she's just one of us.' It's one of the nicest things I've ever had said about me." And church was important to Virginia Price for this reason. She said, "The hardest thing I had to contend with was my own family, because nobody understood how I felt about it. It's hard to go against your neighborhood and your friends, but it's even harder to go against your own family." Sometimes it could be funny. Two couples from the Huntsville, Alabama church, John and Joan Cashin, and Myrna and Don Copeland, did something hilarious. The Cashins, a black couple. The Copelands, a white couple. In 1963, they joined together in an elaborate integration of the Grand Ole Opry up the highway from Huntsville in Nashville. The quartet pulled up in front of the Ryman Auditorium in the Cashins' 1952 Rolls-Royce. Clad in a chauffeur's uniform, Don Copeland, white, climbed from behind the wheel to open the doors for the Cashins, who wore evening attire, while Myrna stepped out in a maid's uniform. John Cashin explained at the door that Don was his trusted chauffeur and butler, while Joan said, "I have to have my maid." Some places were harder than others. Birmingham, Alabama was especially tough. In 1961, John Ciardi was the poetry editor of Saturday Review, a magazine that some of you may be mature enough to remember. John Sciardi was invited by the Alabama Education Association to speak at their annual meeting. And then Saturday Review published a column by him entitled, "Jim Crow is Treason." The invitation was revoked. An invitation was extended by the Unitarian Church of Birmingham to cover his travel and housing, and he accepted and spoke to an integrated audience in the Birmingham Unitarian Church. In Birmingham in 1961, it was still illegal to have an integrated game of checkers, much less an integrated auditorium. Carolyn Fuller grew up in that church with activist parents. She learned well to live out her Unitarian principles. When her high school was integrated by one black student, she did the radical thing. She spoke to him. As a result, she was effectively ostracized for the rest of the school year. In an email to me in 2000, she said of the church, "It was an oasis. Even though former members who attended my public school would avoid me, the only people I considered real friends came from that church. I'm not sure if I would have survived emotionally if it had not been for the church. We were under siege, which caused us to pull close together. Almost all of my positive childhood memories are from the church. The Sunday school class was the only place I felt intellectually stimulated and emotionally supported." And the church, longtime church secretary in Birmingham, came up with what I regard as the best one-liner that I've heard a Unitarian Universalist apply in this era. "One day, Eve fielded yet another telephoned bomb threat at the church office." Birmingham was sometimes referred to as Bombingham. There were so many dynamite blasts. But that day, she had just headed up to here. The threat was made, and her response was, "You'll have to take your turn. There are several people ahead of you." In Knoxville, Tennessee, my home church now, in 1950, it was a one-year-old congregation meeting in rented quarters in a public junior high school. One morning, the greeter was standing out at the front door next to the sign that said, "Everyone welcome." Jim Pearson walked up and said, "Does that include me?" The greeter said, "Certainly, come on in." Because Jim Pearson was black and continued to attend, the church shortly entered the period of its history referred to by its minister as wandering in the wilderness. In 7 Sundays, they met in 6 different places, sometimes having to set up a Saturday telephone tree to let members and friends know where they would be that Sunday. But to come back to Selma, lots of Unitarian Universalists from elsewhere went to Selma at various times. What about Unitarian Universalists from Alabama? On the Saturday before the date we have come to know as Bloody Sunday, a white Lutheran who had grown up in Selma and whose parents still lived there organized a march. Joe Elwanger led 72 concerned white citizens of Alabama. He led them to the courthouse, and from the courthouse steps read a statement in support of black voting rights. 36 out of the 72 concerned white citizens of Alabama were Unitarian Universalists. I didn't know we had 50% of the white population of Alabama. For Southern Unitarian Universalists in the Civil Rights era, the church was the place to become grounded, centered, and energized. It was also the place to be supported when the majority in society said, no, no, no. With church support, they could reflect on their experience and gather the strength to go back out again, back out into society at large to once again put their religious values into action. This alternation between contemplation and doing, between reflection and praxis, has some interesting parallels to liberation theology that energized and liberalized the Catholic Church in Latin America. And to me, it seems a useful pattern, a path to relevant faith. Maybe the church should play a similar role for us today. Does the world at large reflect our values, or does it challenge them? Should we be conformed to the world as it is, or should we put our beliefs and values to the test of attempting to transform the world out there? Those were the challenges in Selma. But also before Selma and beyond. And challenges for us yet today. Our closing hymn is listed in the order of service with a hymn number, but don't bother to get your hymnal out, because this is not a song that can be properly sung with a book in your hands. Maybe somebody else's hand in your hand, but not a book. And there is a Unitarian Universalist portion to the history of this song. This song started out in the black church. I'll be all right. I'll be all right. I'll be all right someday. On a picket line in the Carolinas, some fresh wording was improvised. I'll overcome. And that was carried to the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee by Zilphia Horton. And Zilphia Horton taught it to her friend Pete Seeger, who has had a long history with Unitarian churches, was a member at the time of his death a couple of years ago. And Pete Seeger taught it to a couple of younger singers, Frank Hamilton and Guy Carawan. Guy just died earlier this year in May. And Guy also had strong, long Unitarian Universalist ties. Guy is the person most responsible for transmitting this to the young sit-in students of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And they transformed it into the hymn of the civil rights movement. It's no longer that confined. It's been sung all over the world. It was sung in Gdansk, Poland, in Polish. It was sung in Tiananmen Square. It's been sung in Israel, Palestine, in both Hebrew and Arabic. It's a worldwide phenomenon. And it really is best transmitted orally. I first encountered this song in 1962 in a church in Atlanta, Georgia. I was one of two Americans driving a group of European students and young adults. And the Unitarian Universalists of Atlanta had a long-standing relationship with this Black Baptist church. They had joint youth group meetings. As far as I know, the only place in Atlanta in the early 1960s where black and white youth met and interacted as equals. So they arranged for us to meet with the youth group at the church, and the senior pastor met with us and spoke to us about what was happening right then in Albany, Georgia. And the meeting concluded with this song that I had never heard before, with the senior pastor calling out each stanza as we got to it. So I heard this song first as led by Martin Luther King Sr., Daddy King. I received from him, you are next in line. Carry it forward. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall live in peace.
We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace someday. Oh, dear.
we'll walk hand in hand.